Okay, so today, so I'm very happy to introduce Marko Simonovic as our speaker. Marko got his PhD from CISA, I believe, working with Paolo Cremonelli, is that right?
Yes.
Then he was a postdoc at the IIS in Princeton, where I met him. He was there for a number of years, I forget how many, before he moved to CERN, where he is now. Right, and so in Geneva right now, it's very late at night, but Marko very kindly agreed to stay up past his bedtime to talk to us. So he's done a range of very interesting work, broadly related to the topic of extracting cosmological information from cosmological data. And so today, Marko has very kindly agreed to give us an overview of his recent work. Okay, and so Marko, whenever you're ready, take it away.
Okay, thank you very much. So thanks a lot for the invitation and for the very nice introduction. I'm very happy to give this talk, and it's a pity that I cannot visit in person. We will have to leave it for some other time. But yes, I will say a few words about our some of the recent papers, mainly done in collaboration with Mikhail Ivanov, who is a postdoc at NYU, and Oliver Philcox, a student at Princeton University, and Matthias Lodriak at the IIS. I think this is a bit of a culmination of things that we were doing for a very long time now, and also other people, of course, many other people were involved, and the idea, as Neil said, was to somehow get to the point where we can reliably extract cosmological parameters from large-scale structure surveys. People were doing this for a very long time already, and I'm going to say what are some similarities to what was done before and what are some differences. Okay, so... as we all know, most of the things that we know about cosmology come from the study of density fluctuations. They are very sensitive to both initial conditions and also the matter content of the universe. And so the precision measurements that we have about the abundances of dark matter, baryons, and also cosmological constant, and so on and so forth, are really coming from the precision measurements of the density fluctuations in the CMB and also a bit in the large-scale structure. But these two different probes are having a bit of a different, I think, status. So on one hand, the CMB is very nice because the physics is linear and it is relatively straightforward to calculate the predictions. But it has a limited number of modes, and we cannot probably exploit it much more than we already do. So there are future CMB experiments which are going to improve error bars on many cosmological parameters, but the number of Fourier modes is roughly going to double when we add polarization on smaller scales and improve noise, particularly in polarization. While on the other hand, the large-scale structure probes are getting bigger and bigger, and we are going to have maps of the density fluctuations in the universe in larger and larger volumes and at earlier and earlier times, higher redshifts. So then the question is, where is the point where, or is there a point where the large-scale structure becomes the leading probe, or at least becomes very important complementary probe to the CMB? In some sense, it already is now, as I'm going to mention, but really the question is how far can we push it? And an important aspect of this, an important reason why we want to do this is because there are many unanswered questions that we would like to have answers to, and those include various things from inflation, primordial non-Gaussianities, various possible modifications of the early universe physics, possible existence of new long-range forces maybe in the dark sector, modifications of gravity, exploration of dark energy, and so on and so forth. So all these things require more data, and to make sense of this more data, we have to be able to have a good handle on how to predict, for example, the density fluctuation maps, as you can see here on the right-hand side, and how to analyze. And importantly, nominally, the large-scale structure has much more information, because if you just count Fourier modes, you will see that actually there are many more Fourier modes in the large-scale structure than in the CMB. But of course, there are more complications because things are more nonlinear, and then the real questions of how well can we do. Now, let me say just very briefly to remind you, because I'm sure that all of you have seen this many times, but how do we get cosmological parameters from the CMB power spectrum? And so let me neglect for the time being the initial conditions, so the amplitude and the tilt. Let's set this aside. But then what is left in lambda CDM, let's also focus on lambda CDM as an example, are basically two so-called shape parameters, which are this little omega baryon and omega called dark matter. And then there is a Hubble parameter as a third parameter. There's also, of course, the optical depth of the organization, but it's an astrophysical parameter. So let me not discuss that either. So the way that this works is that the shape parameters are basically or the ratios in the abundances of baryons and cold dark matter decide the relative heights and shapes of these acoustic peaks. So if you have a very detailed measurement, as we do in the CMB, of the acoustic peaks in the CMB, then you can get a nice, almost model-independent measurement of little omega baryon and omega cold dark matter. Then, once you know that, then you can calculate, for example, how far the sound waves propagate in the early universe. This has some scale, the sound horizon, which is very closely to the BO scale. And this is some function of these quantities. And you can use this scale, which you can translate basically into some kind of angular scale where you see these acoustic peaks, as we observe them today, to infer what is the value of the Hubble constant. This, of course, assumes that you know how to calculate the distance to the CMB. And for that, the assumption of lambda CDM, which is flat and so on, is very important. So once you work within lambda CDM standard model, so the shape of the power spectrum tells you about this little omega baryon cold dark matter, and then measurements of various distances or how the CMB looks to you from the current time tells you what is the value of the Hubble constant. Okay, so this is how we do it in the CMB. And the point here of what I'm trying to say is that the large scale structure is really identical to this. So if you measure some density fluctuations in the late universe, you can think of it as some sort of like CMB-like. I mean, they're not CMB, of course, but you can think of another density fluctuation which is closer to us. And in principle, we should be able to repeat the exact same exercise, okay? More traditionally, this is not really what is being done. So let me just also briefly remind you, what are the things that we usually measure from large scale structure. So, of course, when we look at the density field of galaxies, and here I'm talking mainly about galaxies, there the equivalent of this angular power spectrum for the CMB is the two-point correlation function, now in 3D space, or the power spectrum, this Fourier transform. And if you take a look at the shape of this correlation function, you will immediately notice that there is there is a well-defined, very, very nice feature, which is the BEO peak. Okay, so those wiggles that are there in the CMB power spectrum, which are also there in the matter, linear matter power spectrum, when you do a Fourier transform and you go to the correlation function, becomes a peak in the correlation function, the BEO peak. Yeah, and so this scale is probably the simplest thing and the easiest thing to measure from the large scale structure surveys. So in principle, what you have to do if you have the data points is to have some relatively broad model for the broadband, which is general enough to capture the broadband correlation function and should identify the peak on top of that. And so the measurement of the BEO scale is the simplest thing that you can do and people have been doing it, but it's also very important because in combination with the Planck likelihood, measurements of the BEO scale at low redshift are very powerful, maybe not within the lambda CDM context itself very much, but any extension of the lambda CDM then is much better constrained combining Planck and BEO results. And in Planck paper, you will often see this combination, okay? And for example, it helps a lot with neutrino masses. It helps a lot with any extensions of the lambda CDM where you have some non-trivial expansion history, late times and so on. Now, the next thing that you can do, so some additional information that you can add from the galaxy power spectrum is to start to look at the amplitude, for example, of fluctuations. Okay. Now things there already get a bit more complicated, and so let me also remind you how does it work. So I'm writing here the simplest possible formula for the clustering of galaxies in redshift space. This is the famous Kaiser formula. And you can see that now, of course, because you have some preferred direction in the problem, which is the line of sight, the two-point function of the power spectrum is not isotropic anymore, but it depends on the angle between the Fourier mode and the line of sight, which is given the cosine of this angle, this mu. And another complication, of course, is that galaxies are biased tracers of the underlying matter field, and therefore there are some nuances, cosmological parameters, bias parameters, and in this formula, this is this B1. And if we were in real space, so if there was no this anisotropy, then the formula would be simply B1 squared times P linear. And you can see that there is an exact degeneracy between in the linear theory, between the linear bias B1 and the amplitude of the power spectrum. However, thanks to the redshift space distortions, if you really expand this formula, you can see that you can constrain two independent observables. One is B1 times sigma 8, which is the square root of the amplitude of the power spectrum. And the other one is F times sigma 8. And F times sigma 8 is really a cosmological parameter. You can think of it as some complicated combination of these more fundamental cosmological parameters. But anyhow, this is something what we want to get. In other words, this F sigma 8, in some sense, is really related to the quadrupole, or basically the ratio of the monopole and quadrupole in the data. So if you go on large scales where you can apply this formula, roughly speaking, then you can measure, for example, here I'm showing some example of the Bose measurement of the monopole and the quadrupole is one, in one of the data chunks. And if you stay on large scales, you can use this as a model to estimate how large is your F sigma. So this is another important observable, which in combination with CMB maybe is not so powerful, but it is very important for constraining any modifications in the growth rate, for example, in the late universe, whatever can such things can happen, modify gravity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think this is the something which is the most commonly extracted from the large scale structure. So the BL scale and the F sigma 8. And so the standard full shape analysis of the Bose data, and there are really many papers from Bose collaboration. I'm just listing here some of them. So for example, if you're focusing on the power spectrum, there you can do the BAO and F sigma 8 analysis jointly at the same time. And this is what is usually called the full shape analysis. So the full shape here means that we're not just looking at the BAO peak or the BAO wiggles in Fourier space, but we're actually trying to get constraints using also the broadband in the way that I just described previously, except that, of course, we're not using the linear formula anymore, but something more complicated, some nonlinear model. And we are getting the BAO scale and the amplitude of the power spectrum or F sigma 8 parameter at the same time. Now, I want to emphasize that while this looks very similar to what I just discussed previously about the CMB, it is a bit different. And let me explain in what sense. So what this full shape analysis does technically is to actually fix the shape parameters. For example, omega baryon and little omega baryon and little omega CDM is fixed to their best fit Planck values, such that basically the shape of the linear power spectrum is kept fixed. Okay. So once you have this fixed linear power spectrum, you can calculate the nonlinear power spectrum. And in MCMC chains, you're varying only the amplitude through F sigma 8, and you're varying distances because you need some way to convert distances to the angles and redshifts in the sky. And also you're varying nuisance parameters. So in this nonlinear model, as you may know, there are many nuisance parameters like this bias parameter that I mentioned before, and also other nonlinear biases, the shot noise and so on. And so, but they're all some kind of multiplicative factors multiplying these fixed templates that you calculate fixing the shape parameters using Planck, okay?
Wait, Marco, just to clarify for me, like when you say that you're fixing the template, You know, that means that you're fixing the linear power spectrum, right?
Yes.
You know, the shape of the nonlinear power spectrum changes as you change sigma 8, right?
Yes, okay. yes, exactly. So it changes as you change sigma 8, it changes as you change bias parameter, it changes as you change distances, because you can like squeeze it like through this alpha power for perpendicular, like horizontally and vertically. But you do not vary, for example, things that will change the shape of the linear power spectrum. Okay, that is one thing that you don't do in standard full shape analysis. Now, this means that you're using the whole power spectrum, but you're not maybe using you're not exploring the shape, and the shape is fixed. This is the point I want to make. And you see, this is a bit different from the CMB analysis. So there, it was very important to vary the shape parameters, and we're getting them from the CMB. So now, why do we do this? Well, I'm sure that there are many different answers to this question, including the historical development of the field. But I think that this procedure makes perfect sense for at least two reasons. One is that the Planck error bars on these shape parameters are going to be much tighter, at least in the lambda CDM model, than what you can get from galaxy surveys. So therefore, even if you were to vary, for example, these parameters, but then impose Planck prior to the end, effectively, you will get the same answer. So then you can basically fix these shape parameters from the very beginning. This is one reason. And the second reason is that this likelihood that you get at the end of the day in terms of F sigma 8 and like these various distances is more convenient to test various expansion histories in the late universe. And therefore it's more convenient to maybe deal to basically constrain models of modified gravity or dynamical dark energy. However, at the same time, like now that if you answer this way, at the same time, you may get a bit nervous about this procedure, because obviously there are many imagined situations in which the simple F sigma 8 plus BAO full shape analysis can fail. And for instance, what if you have some more complicated early dark universe model, early universe model where you have more parameters, you open up some degeneracy directions, and then the Planck error bars increase. And then I think it becomes difficult maybe to argue that choosing one particular value of any of these shape parameters is maybe good enough. So that is one option where things can become a bit difficult, and I'm going to show one example of that sort. Another option is that like if there is a tension between different cosmological data sets, then it's a bit dangerous to use priors from one and like use it in another one. So it is usually a good idea, I think, to try to keep things separately and then maybe combine at the end just to make sure that everything's okay. And also there is this like option, which is not very realistic, but we never know, is that maybe there is some systematic error in Planck for which the Planck priors that you eventually use are maybe not perfectly correct. And it is always good to check, I think, what, for example, large-scale structure can tell us without using Planck, and then we can combine later on. So no problem. So these are maybe some reasons. So the usual F sigma plus BO is fine, but it's a very efficient way to compress the information. But there are some situations which you may be worried, where doing this procedure may be a bit wrong. And so now, of course, people knew this for a very long time. This is not something that I'm telling you, because obviously this is how the CMB is done, and like in the back of people's mind, there was always this procedure. And in fact, very, very early on, like some of the first analyses of the SDSS data were done in this way. So here I'm showing some old paper where, for example, you can look at the analysis where basically the full shape is used in this sense. That not only amplitude is varied, but actually also the shape parameters. And you can see like here, the posteriors, I think that the yellow contours here are the SDSS data. The orange contours are some version of WMAP, maybe WMAP 3, I'm not quite sure. And then the red contours are the joint results. And you can see that there are some cosmological parameters for which the so-called full shape analysis at the time was, of course, contributing quite significantly. And it is true that in the meantime, the CMB became much better. So there was this reason that I mentioned that Planck now is so precise that maybe it doesn't make sense to do this, obviously, this way. But anyhow, this idea of using the full shape of galaxy power spectrum was, of course, always there. And it is only that I think that for simplicity and to compress the information, F sigma A plus BAO was used in practice. Okay. Now, so I think that also there is another reason why maybe doing the full shape analysis is a bit difficult. And in principle, there are two obstacles if you really want to do it. One is that you really have to believe, I mean, if you go back to these papers and you take a look how people were modeling the nonlinear power spectrum, you will see that essentially they had some kind of a fudge functions that will turn the linear power spectrum to the nonlinear power spectrum. And there was not really much of a detailed understanding where does it come from and like how precise or reliable this is. So you really, like if you want to go to higher, more precise data such as Bose, you really have to have a very good model. So this is one thing that you need, and you need something reliable that you can believe that it will give you unbiased cosmological parameters. And I think that there was a long history there of trying to find the models for the power spectrum in Rashid space using some analytical methods like perturbation theory. And I think that the combination of these efforts came in this effective field theory for large scale structure, which was, I think, an important conceptual step forward. And I think that this is really a consistent way to do perturbation theory, which maybe is not, you may say, like, well, but these analytical methods are not very good because they're not very precise and so on, but at least it is guaranteed that it doesn't give you any biased answer, or it will not lead to like some problems when you try to compare like your predictions either with simulations or with the data. So this is a big subject and many people were working on this. It was very very active area of research in the last decade or so. And the key ingredient there is that people understood how to, I think the thing which was missing in some earlier description was that there is a very important effect which comes from the fact that the small scales can influence the large scales, and but they cannot do it in an arbitrary way. There is a systematic way to describe first of all, the perturbative solutions, how the long wavelength fluctuations interact with each other, but also how the small scale fluctuations back react on the long wavelength modes. And this systematic way to describe these effects, it comes through this effective theoretical structure. And another important point, I think, was that it is finally clarified in great detail, not only, I mean, qualitatively it was understood a long time ago, but quantitatively in great detail it is clear how to really treat the BAO peak properly, how to really understand how to calculate reliably the spread of the BAO peak and the nonlinear damping. And that is another important aspect which I think is quite relevant for this discussion. I will not say much about this modeling because I think that if I start explaining all the details, it will take too much time. But this was one important step, and it's something that people didn't have like 10 years ago. Now, the second important step, of course, is to be able to efficiently evaluate these nonlinear spectra once you have some model. Okay, usually those models involve some convolutions of the initial conditions, and these integrals can be numerically heavy. But there was some progress in basically using FFT log to simplify evaluation of these integrals and make it very easy and very fast. And this combined with implementation of all these equations and all these like complicated formalism into the Boltzmann solvers. It's not such that now we have extensions of Boltzmann solvers, which can basically for any input of the cosmological parameters for any cosmological model just give you the output in like 1 second, which is like the nonlinear power spectrum. That was also one important ingredient in order to be able to like run MCMC analysis in the real time. And so I would like to say
something like you know, so how important actually is it to do all these nonlinear, you know, loop integrals for each evaluation in parameter space? I mean, you know, because like my impression was that you would have like, you know, some templates that you're adding up with some coefficients to get your final nonlinear.
Yes, but if you change, for example, omega matter, then these templates will change. Now you may ask, but is this important for my analysis? Because the loop corrections are anyhow subdominant compared to the linear theory. So do I have to vary cosmological parameters inside the loops? So that is one good question. And I don't know the answer for Bose, but I certainly know that for larger surveys, it is important. If you try to do this exercise that we basically vary the linear power spectrum properly, the shape is always reevaluated. And we also change the amplitude of the loops properly and bias parameters and so on. But if you don't vary the cosmological parameters inside the loops, or when you calculate the loop contributions, you can get biased. Yeah, that's unfortunately is important.
Okay, great, thanks.
So we have this code which I think is like it's very simple to use. It is basically the same as class. If you can install class, you can install also this, and it's an extension of class which has one extra nonlinear module. And this code basically is what the whole thing that we want to talk about is based on. So you can download the code in Bose likelihood in these two websites, or you can always send an email to Anton Chudaik. And by the way, he will come eventually when he gets visa to McMaster, I believe, to work with Sergei Sibiryakov. So he will be nearby, and or Misha Ivanov, Robert Filkov, all of them are regularly updating the code, and they'll be happy to answer if you have any technical difficulties. Obviously, I'm not saying to write to me because I'm not the right person to ask about technical difficulties, but if you would like to know how the code works, what does it do, what is it based on, if you have any questions about that, you can, of course, ask me as well. Okay, but I'm not going to talk about perturbation theory very much, but I would like to maybe say a couple of words just to show you that what we are doing really makes some sense. It's not some kind of by chance. And so one piece of evidence that I can offer you, which I'm offering only because it is visually very nice, is the following exercise. Imagine that you run an n-body simulation, and here for the time being, I'm in real space. So, and you identify dark matter halos. And for instance, you make a map in real space of these dark matter halos, just smoothed with some simple filter. And then you get something from simulation, which looks like this, okay? Then imagine you take the same initial conditions because you remember the seed on the simulation, and you take this realization and run perturbation theory with it. So you use basically the same formulas that we use to calculate the power spectrum, except that we really do it on the realization level. Then if you use the one loop power spectrum, which means that you have to keep all the bias parameters and nonlinearities to cubic order, then you're going to get something that looks like this, okay? And you can already see that even by eye, these two maps look very similar. They may disagree on small scales, which is fine, what we expect, but all large scale features are identical. And you can do a very nice test, which doesn't depend on cosmic variance, because you can compare these two maps. Since they have the same seed, they have to be identical if the model is perfect. And you can measure to what extent you're recovering the true nonlinear density field. And actually, it works very well. I mean, almost perfectly, given the realistic shot noise that real halos have. So, for instance, here at the bottom, I'm showing what happens if you take the full nonlinear matter field from a simulation and use the linear Eulerian bias. So this model, of course, even by eye, is worse than what you get here. But let me not go into more details. Of course, you may say this is not a fair comparison because you're using linear bias versus cubic bias. But even if you go to higher orders, it turns out actually this map is closer to the truth. So I think that this really shows you that on the map level, perturbation theory works very well. And this means that not only the power spectrum will be correct, but also all other endpoint functions. Okay, and this I think gives us confidence that that what we're doing makes sense. Another thing that we did as a test for this Bose analysis is to do a perturbation theory challenge. This is a cute challenge set up by Takahiro Nishimishi and Masahiro Takata. They ran 10 boxes with a very large volume. The combined volume of all simulations is something like 600 gigaparsecs for h cubed. So the challenge was blind, so it means that they told us what is the tilt and the ratio of omega baryon to omega CDN, but no other cosmological parameter. So they gave us the data. So this is like redshift space, galaxies, populated with HOD. So they have satellites and everything. It's supposed to simulate the realistic galaxy survey. And you can see, for example, the outputs here. So this is the quadrupole and this is the monopole. And the error bars are so tiny that you cannot even see it by eye. So if you look at the relative errors on these quantities, for example, this here is 1%. So for example, the error in this large volume on the monopole is below 0.1% in all these beans, and the quadrupole is around 1%. So these are very, this is not a realistic volume, but the idea here was to really test perturbation theory. Like when we say that we can recover cosmological parameters in an unbiased way, can we really do it in such a high precision settings, okay? And the dangerous thing about it was that the deal was that whatever we send them, they're going to put publicly either on archive or somewhere, so that if you get it right, it's good. If you don't get it right, it will be very bad. So something was at stake in this bet. So luckily, we were able to recover all the cosmological parameters in an unbiased way using like this class PT code and the procedure that we just explained, barring all cosmological parameters, including like omega matter, Hubble, and the amplitude.
And so you matched a better than percent, is that what you're saying?
What is shown here is our best fit. And it's a residual plot for the best fit.
Are the simulations themselves precise? I mean, at this level?
I think that they are not, but I think that...
To match better than the accuracy of the simulations? I mean, like, I don't...
Let me say this. I think that if there is any inaccuracy in the simulations, first of all, yeah, these are halos, so you should identify large halos because this sample is similar to Bose sample, so you don't have to get perfectly small scales. You have very small statistical error bars, like as you can see, but there is no like really. I think that we're not going to very small scales where some trouble can happen. We believe that simulations have the correct growth factor. That was something that we had to believe. And I think that at the 0.1% level, this is a bit challenging, but Takahiro claimed that it is okay, that he checked very carefully and this is fine. And then the rest of the problems can be from somehow small scales propagating again on large scales, but that should be captured by all these bias parameters, EFT parameters and so on anyhow. So the only danger will be somehow that we're getting slightly biased bias parameters, I think. But I agree with you that there is a concern that maybe the simulation. I mean, at that point, we had to believe that the simulations are okay. Because if you ask for smaller simulation, people will say, "Oh, this is only because you're afraid to fit the large ones." So,
if you don't know that your small-scale bias parameters are correct, then you don't know you've got the correct model. You just know that you've managed to fit the right shape to within this.
Yes, exactly. So, not on small scale bias. What I really meant is that the small scale distribution of mass. Let me even talk about only dark matter. Okay. So imagine that you're fitting the dark matter power spectrum rather than just. I think that imagine that there is some perfect truth, a perfect simulation, and then you run your approximate n-body simulation, such as this one. As you get the large scales correctly, so as long as the growth on large scales is fine and so on. These two simulations, if you look at the map level, they're going to disagree only in the distribution of matter on small scales. So if you calculate the power spectrum of this disagreement, what I'm trying to say is that this power spectrum will exactly look like the effective field theory counterterms, because they're exactly designed to tell you that small details, small differences between perturbation theory and the truth, or one simulation or another on small scales, can propagate to large scales only in the particular shapes. And since you're marginalized over those, I think that you should not be worried very much about the details on small scales. Now, I think that if you're thinking about more physical problems, like how many central galaxies you have, of what type, in which halo masses and satellites and so on and so forth, I agree that these samples are going to have well-defined bias parameters. And if your simulation is wrong, you're going to get a different bias parameter. So, but given that we were not checking bias parameters here, I think that, yeah, that was the only thing that maybe remains to be checked.
But just to make sure that I'm understanding this, you know, so for example, so if you had tried this using like Gadget 2 or something instead of Cola, you know, would you have gotten like the wrong cosmological parameters?
I think that I will repeat, as long as the simulation gives you the right large scales.
So, yeah, so there, yeah,
the,
right,
there's
yeah.
a problem about the growth. If this is not there, like
Cola, that's what I mean though. What I mean though, right? You know, so Gadget 2, for example, right? So we know that it has these like, you know, more than percent level, you know, errors in the matter power spectrum on large scales.
Yes, I think that Takahiro claimed that he did some resolution and some time steps and so on, and tests, or that he thinks that this is not the case. But
right.
I cannot comment more.
Yeah, simulations are fine in here, I mean, presumably. My question is, you know, whether or not, you know, this analysis method that you're talking about.
No. If the simulation has a 1% problem, you will see 1% bias in the amplitude, yeah.
Okay.
No, of course. No, that for sure. The only problem which we'll not see is that if simulation is perfectly fine on large scales, but on small scales is different. Mm-hmm. For example, like halos are a bit more compact, or it doesn't know how to do those kind of things. Look like only like this K squared times P linear terms and stuff like this. So
Marco, do you know like where that, can you say quantitatively where that breaks down so that you can kind of really start to, can you use the simulations and the sort of different simulations that you're using to see, I mean, here you've got a sort of scale that might be, yes. I mean, you'd like to know exactly how far down in scale you can push this
I think that for sure I would believe the perturbation theory breaks down first. I cannot imagine that simulation will break down first in any setup. Now, if you're really asking about simulations, where do they break down? I think that, for example,
I'm asking how far you can push the PT. So I'm asking how far, where are you? I mean, obviously, once you get into the sort of one halo.
Oh, absolutely. Look.
Right. Here, that's when you start to.
Yes. There you're completely off. I think that. So what is a relevant question to me is always, I think that realistically, we're never inside one halo because the shot noise typically is large enough that it will basically prevent you from entering one halo term effectively, unless you look at some very special sample, which is very high number density and so on. But at least like, for example, particularly if you think about doing some kind of a larger redshift surveys, then I think the shot noise will be always below.
For example?
Sorry, it will be always larger than your uncertainties that you're making in the perturbation theory. And I think that you will be always fine in practice. In theory, if you really had some much higher resolution, then it would break down, of course, even before you enter one halo. And also, again, what does it mean break down? Depends a bit on the volume. If you have a huge volume, infinite volume, then it breaks down immediately because, of course, it's not perfect. But if you have a realistic volume, I think that then you can do something, I think, reasonable. Yeah. So anyhow, I think that another message that I wanted to make here is that we do see, like, for example, we reported our results at some scale here, like 0.12, 0.14, because we believe that with such a big simulation box, this is where we can still believe our population. We can estimate how big our next order corrections and so on. But even if you apply the same nonlinear model and you go all the way to K of 0.2, yes, you get very much biased given this huge volume. But if you rescale the error bars to the Bose volume, which is this gray line, sorry, the yellow and blue line, then you see that this model is perfectly fine for the Bose galaxy, for the Bose volumes. And it cannot make a significant shifts in the cosmological parameters. So this was a good exercise to make sure that what we can do with the currently available data sets with this Bose galaxies is really something like what we can believe. Okay, so again, the idea here is to, and now of course I'm like super late, but the idea here is to do the analysis in the exact same way as we do it for the CMB. We vary all cosmological parameters, okay? In all the analysis I'm going to show, we use only the BBM prior on omega baryon, because otherwise things will be, like, still you will get some meaningful constraints, but they will be degraded by like 30 to 50%. So we use BBM prior, but nothing else. So we vary all cosmological parameters, including also the neutrino masses. And of course, in this analysis, there are many gnosis parameters, the usual bias parameters, the shot noise, and a few other numbers, which are exactly this EFT counter terms, something that is not usually there in these models. And they're there to really fix all these issues from small scales leaking on large scales. And this includes all kinds of nonlinearities in real space, fingers of God, rash space distortions, everything, okay? And so the idea is that then once we have this machinery where we can put in the cosmology and cosmological parameters and the computer tell us the nonlinear power spectrum, we can compare it to the data, run MCMC, and get cosmological parameters. Now, let me very briefly, I think that in the interest of time, I may skip this, but it is important. Let me also say that we're also trying to exploit, so this all will work for the simple nonlinear power spectrum, multiples, and so on and so forth. But we know that we can get a bit more information about the BEO scale if we do the reconstruction. So if you're not familiar with this, I will not explain it in detail. But of course, the reconstruction helps us to sharpen the BEO wiggles, or in real space to sharpen the BEO peak, and gives us a bit better idea about the BEO scale, which in turn is important for the Hubble parameter. So we do it in a slightly different way than what is usually done. Essentially, it is the same. It is, of course, always the same. You want to somehow fit the BEO wiggles in the reconstructed power spectrum, marginalizing over the broadband. But the way that we marginalize over the broadband is a bit different. Usually, people come up with some polynomial, which has sufficiently many degrees of freedom to basically mimic the broadband. But it's a bit difficult there because you always have to be careful not to put too many coefficients, because otherwise it will start fitting the wiggles, and also not to put too few to have enough flexibility to fit the broadband. So to avoid this issue, we do it in a way which is a bit strange at first, but it actually works very nicely without any adjustments or really out of the box. And this is to really like inflate the error bars of the reconstructed power spectrum a lot, so that basically we cannot measure the broadband even, but we make them correlated on scales larger than the BEO wiggles, such that then if we fit for the BEO template, we're going to get the BEO scale effectively marginalizing over all possible broadbands without assuming any functional form. So if you want, you can take a look at the paper for more details. It's a very practical, simple, and fast way to extract the BEO scale without really splitting making a model for the background power spectrum, which can be a bit difficult unless you just do some polynomial for the
reconstruction. What's the reason for doing this, Marco? Reason to marginalize over this like large scale shape?
Because I think that we don't want we have two spectra. Okay, one is what you measure directly from the sky, and the other one is you first do reconstruction and then you measure the power spectrum. So now you have two things. Now what is nice about the reconstructed power spectrum is that it has sharper wiggles, and this is what you want. But the broadband is very complicated, and modeling the broadband is like very difficult. So we want to marginalize over it because we anyhow have the broadband in the original power spectrum. We only want to keep like the BEO wiggles from the other reconstructed spectra. Okay. So that is the reason. And at the end of the day, the data vector that we have is like the usual P of KI, so the full thing, the nonlinear spectrum that you measure, and plus two numbers, alpha par, alpha perpendicular, for the reconstructed spectra, but only extracted from the BEO wiggles. So this is the data vector. And of course, we have to put the proper covariance between the two because we are double counting a bit of the wiggles. And this covariance is very easy to get from MOX, or if you can even calculate analytically. And the calculation and the mocks agree perfectly. So it is a very simple procedure which can basically do this combination of the full shape with the usual BEOs plus reconstruction, just to enhance a bit the sensitivity to the BEO scale and to improve the measurements of the Hubble constant. So let me now finally say, what do we learn? I mean, applying all this machinery to the Bose data, which is what we currently have. So what do we get from some real causes. So first of all, let me say something about, let me see how much time do I have. Oh, it's almost an hour. So let me first say something about the Lambda CDM only. So we use the BBM prior in our analysis, as I said, and what is shown here are three different contours. So the red contours are Planck results for Lambda CDM. The gray contours is the full shape, but in this sense that I mentioned, that they're varying all cosmological parameters. And full shape here means only really taking the nonlinear monopole and quadrupole and fitting them in the way that I described without using the BEO reconstruction. Okay. And the blue curves are full shape plus BA reconstruction. This I'm going to call FS plus BA always from now. And you can see that the only real improvement is for the Hubble constant when you do the BA reconstruction. And this is what we expect because it's about measuring a scale, which is related to the Hubble scale. While, for example, sigma 8 or omega CDM, the error bars do not change very much significantly between doing the full shape or adding the BA information. Another thing that you can see now here is what I discussed earlier, that you see, we took the post data and basically measured the lambda CDM cosmological parameters from it without using Planck. And it is very nice to check that the post data agree, broadly speaking, with Planck. I mean, there is maybe a bit of a very little bit of attention in terms of sigma 8, but it is not really significant. It is like maybe 1.5 sigma or something like that in the marginalized posterior. So broadly speaking, we are consistent with Planck. So Bose and Planck do agree. One interesting result is that if you use Bose data only, like you can measure the Hubble constant to be 68.5 plus minus 1.1. And this is again in agreement with the Planck measurement. And it is in tension with these higher values of the Hubble constant measured by the local measure. So this is another independent confirmation that assuming lambda CDM and the standard cosmological model, you really get lower value or the correct value, I don't know, like the standard value, Planck value for the Hubble constant. All right, so, but as I said, this is somewhat expected that, and you can see here a posteriori that indeed, for example, fixing these shape parameters makes perfect sense for lambda CDM because Planck is so much better. But what happens if we now extend the parameter space? So let me tell you about two interesting extensions. So first of all, if you add an invariant neutrino masses, then the upper bound of the neutrino mass changes. So Planck plus BAO gives you something like 0.12 electron volts, while Planck plus full shape plus BAO will give you somewhat higher upper bound. And this has to do with the fact that a sigma 8 is a bit lower in Bose than it is in Planck. I think that you may think that this is a bit paradoxical because you're degrading constraints, adding more information. But on the other hand, this information also takes into account that maybe sigma 8 should be a bit lower. It is indeed true that Planck constraints on neutrino mass are a bit driven towards the lower values by this ALS tension. And I think it will be very interesting to see if this ALS tension goes away, what happens. For example, ACT data, which recently were released, and they're not as good as Planck, but they do not have any Lansing anomaly. And I think it will be curious to repeat. And in fact, they find much higher upper bounds on the neutrino mass. It will be interesting to repeat the joint analysis and see what can happen there. And another extension is that on top of neutrino mass, you can add also an effective as a free parameter. And in that case, you can see that, for example, compared to the Planck plus BAO, adding the full shape, indeed, improves the error bars a bit. It is not a significant, very big improvement, but it is still 10-15%. And interestingly, an effective doesn't like, it is still compatible with three, of course, but it doesn't like these large values of an effective that maybe would be necessary to maybe make a resolution to the Hubble tension. And indeed, in this model, so lambda CDM plus neutrino mass plus an effective, the Hubble is still 67. So, it is really the case that in the context of the Hubble tension, probably an effective at this point is simply not possible to resolve it. All right, so finally, let me give another example, which is maybe more interesting. And this is like the early dark energy. Again, this was proposed in the context of a resolution to the Hubble tension. The early dark energy is like modification of the early universe physics. Essentially, what you want to do is to change the connection between the sound horizon that I mentioned at the beginning and omega barrier and omega matter by basically changing the energy densities in the early universe. You add a bit of the something which affects the dark energy until the combination and very quickly disappears. And there are ways to do it using some scalar field potentials. And since you need to change the Hubble parameter by 5-10%, you have to change the like physics, recombination physics or the energy density content around that time by 5-10%. And so if you do this, you expect the turbine to change cosmological parameters by 5-10%, and indeed you do. When you find the best fit, for example, CMB point for early dark energy lambda CDM, they have different cosmological parameters, and the linear power spectrum is indeed different by 5-10%, depending on the scale. But when you look at the projected quantities in the angular spectra for the CMB, like polarization and temperature, they're really identical. So here what is shown are two curves. One, you cannot see them because they're one on top of the other. And even though the linear power spectrum is different, you can see that this model is very clever. So it basically has the same observables for the CMB power spectrum. And this is why essentially running the early dark energy model only with the CMB, you cannot really tell them apart. And because you have some degeneracy directions inside. But since the large scale structure is measured in the linear power spectrum more directly, then it's an interesting question to ask, can large scale structure help with this? Can it bring more information? Indeed it can. So I can just briefly say that there were two papers where this is discussed in more detail, but I think for me an interesting lesson, there are many others, but in this context is that, again, there are three curves here. I want to maybe to make one last point and then I'm done. So the green curve is like the early dark energy constraint using the CMB only. And you can see that basically it prefers a bit lower values of Hubble, but it's somewhat compatible with these higher values measured by Cepheids. The blue curve is what you get when you combine Planck and the standard full shape, meaning F sigma plus BAO likelihoods. And the blue curve is very similar to green, and it even has a bit higher Hubble, a very tiny bit, so it's a small difference, but it doesn't change things very much. On the other hand, if you add the full shape in this sense, where you vary also all shape parameters, and those are in this context very important because they are, for example, omega CDM is what is very different between the best fit point for the early dark energy and the lambda CDM, then indeed you will find that you make a shift to the right in this plot. You basically, omega CDM doesn't want to have these larger values, which are allowed by this simple F sigma plus B likelihood or CMB. And because it is degenerate with the early dark energy, it doesn't want large amount of early dark energy, in other words. And therefore, the Hubble constant shifts towards the lower values. And you change the tension from something like 2.5 or 3 sigma to something which is 3.5 or 4 sigma. So addition of this full shape likelihood, in this example, you can see that doing F sigma 8 plus B is not enough. You have to do the full shape likelihood, and only then you're going to get this improvement, which can make a meaningful difference in terms of maybe telling you something about whether this is a good model which resolves the Hubble tension. All right, so one final thing that I can show is like how applying the same machinery, now this is a forecast, so it's not a Fisher forecast, it basically generate the mock data for Euclid or Deselect survey with proper redshift beams and everything, and some estimated covariance, number densities of galaxies and stuff like that. And we run the analysis on this mock data. So it is still a full MCMC analysis, but here I'm just showing what kind of results we can expect. If you believe, first of all, the measurements of this precision, then also the modeling at this precision, you can get some very nice results. So basically, Euclid or DESI with their volumes and redshift range will have similar constraining power as Planck in terms of cosmological parameters. So here, when I say, when this is the paper by Anton Chudak and Mishkiven from last year, when they say like, for example, the one loop power spectrum, it means no BBM prior on omega baryon. So they measure it really from the galaxy survey alone. So here there is no any input other than just large scale structure. And you can see that the contours are similar to Planck. And in particular, in some examples, like Hubble and omega CDM, since they're orthogonal, because you're measuring things at very different redshifts, then you can get a huge improvement in cosmological parameters combining the two things together. So I think that the future is very bright for this program. And I think that with this kind of tools and probably things that we can improve in the future, we have a good chance to really like meet the expectations of this future large-scale structure service. Let me skip this point because it's getting very late. So some future directions that I think would be interesting to explore and that we're looking into it now are is the issue of the covariance matrices, whether simple analytical covariances are enough or we really have to use many mocks. Can we do some data compression which is meaningful such that we reduce the dimensionality of these data vectors, particularly for the higher endpoint statistics? That would be great. One thing that I'm worried, like a bit always worried about, not worried, but like I'm wondering, is like how much of a difference is if you use like FKP estimator, which is used in all these measurements, versus the real optimal estimator? And does it make a difference to large scale, which is significant, so that you can see it in the data analysis? For F sigma 8 plus BAO, I don't think so, because you're looking at overall amplitude, but a bit of information about omega CDM comes from large scales as well. They're important. And it is there that it may make a bit of a difference. Can we get better prior-Zanussi parameters from some HOD modeling or things like that? How much the bi-spectrum helps? This is really an interesting question. I think that it's worth exploring. So since it's getting very late, I will stop here and leave you with the conclusions. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Marco. Here, why don't we all unmute ourselves and applaud audibly, or if you want, not on mute, you can applaud virtually.
Thank you.
Okay, let's see. Yeah, we have time for questions, I think. Okay, let me take my prerogative as the chair to ask the first question. Okay, so probably you saw this paper by Tristan Smith, you know, that was saying, you know, that these, you know, that the full shape constraints on the early dark energy models are overstated. That is just like the prior that you used. So can you comment on that?
Yes. So what we did. I mean, let me just say what we. So we took the exact same model that was used like by the authors of the early dark energy. Like, so this model has many free parameters. Okay. So some of them are fixed by hand already, like this exponent of the potential and so on. But essentially, there are three free parameters in this model. One is like the amplitude of the early dark energy that you need. The other one is at which redshift it peaks compared to other components. And the third one, because you have a scalar field, like, which is like an axiom-like field, then we have some initial phase, which is which can be anything from 0 to 2 pi. And so when we made this statement, what we do is to put some priors on basically the phase of the field can be from 0 to 2 pi. We put a pretty narrow prior on where does the dark energy peaks. It is about recombination in order to favor it as a solution to the Hubble constant. And there is no prior on the amplitude, of course. And so when we run the MCMC chain, we basically marginalize over this parameter. And so this is what was done always, even by the other people when they were doing the CMB analysis. When we were comparing this to the CMB, we were following the same procedure. And I think that when they do the same analysis, they agree with our numbers, okay? Now, they don't agree with the interpretation that or maybe the idea that this is what is supposed to be done in principle. I think that they say that they make I think various arguments, but I think that they're worried that somehow we are dominated by the volume effect of these priors because the field is uncertain. It can be anything between 0 and 2 pi. Also in the limit when the early dark energy is negligible, it can peak at any redshift. Basically, you don't have this. It's not very certain. But as I said, we put a pretty narrow prior on where it peaks. So I don't think that there is a real problem there. So basically, what they then do is to fix by hand two of these three parameters, and don't vary them in the MCMC chain. And then they say that if they have effectively a single parameter model, then the posterior is different. So I think that I agree with this. It's just not clear. Why would you fix some parameters if you don't know them? It's a bit like saying some of the neutrino masses are ruled out only because we marginalize over tau. If you knew tau, the posterior would be different. I think that this is certainly true, but
so which the whole point is that was left open. I mean, to vary. Sorry,
only the amplitude. So they will fix the redshift and they will fix the phase to their best fit values when they do the global fit, and then run again MCMC without varying. Mm-hmm. But if you change these parameters a bit, then it will not work. So you see, somehow you're finely tuning these parameters to make it work. So, and I think that marginalization, because you don't know, is a bit, is the price that you're supposed to pay, because there are many options.
And oh, so you're worried that they're overfitting?
I'm worried that they're not including what is sometimes, for example, in particle physics, if you see a bump in like some plot, you have to, I mean, like there is a look elsewhere effect. Explain why exactly it's here and not somewhere else. So here there is a bit of this look elsewhere effect. I mean, like, why do you choose some particular parameters? Because if you move a bit, it will not work. So I think that they're not overfitting. They're just choosing very carefully the parameters for which the thing looks the best. And they say that this is what matters. Like that there is at least one example for which the tangent is not there. I think that this is a bit unfair because, it becomes a bit of a philosophical discussion, because I think that it's fair to do the standard procedure of marginalizing all these parameters. But in any case, if they marginalize, they agree with all these numbers. So there's no disagreement. It's not a technical disagreement.
Okay, awesome, thanks. Okay, any more questions for Marco? Well, okay, well, you know, let me ask actually one more thing. You know, so on the next slide, where you're showing these future surveys.
Yes.
So what's driving the huge improvement? I mean, like, you know, is it like, you know, like it's not like, it's not pushing to higher K, right? I mean, it's
No. I think that what drives, of course, is the bigger volume. Like these surveys are going to have much bigger volume. They're going to higher redshift, where things are more linear and therefore like more under control. The BO wiggles are more enhanced. And I think that the dominant factor, of course, is a larger volume, also a bit of a higher number density for at least some redshift beams than for Bose. And I think that the major improvement then really is like the fact that, I mean, if you look at these posteriors for Planck and for Lashke structure, you can see in examples where they're orthogonal, then really, for example, the Hubble can be measured 5 times better in combination than each individual experiment. Mm-hmm. So we are very, like, these are super well-known things. I mean, these degeneracies happen because the orthogonal, because the distance enters in these calculations, and different distances rotate the contour. So if you look at it, very different. I mean, the same thing happens, for example, for quasars and galaxies, something very similar. But yes, this is, so if you look at this, and then you know, once you nail down, for example, omega CDM and Hubble, then because of the degeneracies, other parameters improve and so on. So I think that it will be more, even more impressive, you know, for the extensions of lambda CDM. So yes, I think that this is very interesting. But essentially, I'm pretty sure that we're almost ready. If we had the data today, it would take a couple of hours to produce these plots with the real, like, cosmological constraints. And I think that we can still improve probably this, think about all these things that we discussed, but it already looks very good.
I see. Okay. So the first papers, you're saying, after the data is released, will come out like 2 hours afterwards.
Well, no. The SE, of course, the Euclid, they're going to do it first. There will be no. So I'm just saying that in terms of infrastructure, I think that nowadays it is kind of, of course, they can rewrite the calls, they're going to do it maybe more professional and so on, but there is a very clear path forward. And I think that, this is very good.
Okay, great. So any last questions for Marco? So if not, thanks again, Marco, for a fantastic
talk. Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thanks a lot.